with her usual confidence, away from the old estates, out of quiet streets lined with bare-limbed elms and maples, through ever busier thoroughfares, heading to Dr. Emanuel Goodhausen's office on bustling State Street. Ginger had an 11:30 appointment with Goodhausen, whom she had seen twice last week. She was scheduled to visit him every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday until they got to the bottom of her attacks of fugue. In her bleaker moments, Ginger was sure she'd still be lying on Goodhausen's couch 30 years from now. Rita intended to do a bit of shopping while Ginger was with the doctor. Then they would go to lunch at some exquisite restaurant in which, no doubt, the decor would seem to have been planned to flatter Rita Hanaby, and in which Ginger would feel like a schoolgirl, foolishly trying to pass for a grown-up.
"Have you given some thought to what I suggested last Friday?" Rita asked as she drove. "The women's auxiliary at the hospital." "I don't really think I'm up to it. I'd feel so awkward." "It's important work," Rita said, expertly slipping the Mercedes out from behind a Globe newspaper truck into a gap in traffic. "I know. I've seen how much money you've raised for the hospital, the new equipment you've bought. But I think I've got to stay away from Memorial right now. It'd be too frustrating to be around the place, too constant a reminder that I can't do the work I've been trained for." "I understand, dear. Don't give it another thought. But there's still the Symphony Committee, the Women's League for the Aged, and the Children's Advocacy Committee. We could use your help at any of those."
Rita was an indefatigable charity worker, ably chairing committees or serving on them, not only organizing beneficent societies, but getting her hands dirty in the operation of them.
"What about it?" she pressed. "I'm sure you'd find working with children especially rewarding." "Rita, what if I had one of my attacks while I was with the children? It would frighten them, and I..." "Oh, pish-posh," Rita said. "Every time I've gotten you out of the house these last 2 weeks, you've used that same excuse to try to resist leaving your room. 'Oh, Rita,' you say, 'I'll have one of my awful fits and embarrass you,' but you haven't and you won't. Even if you did, it wouldn't embarrass me. I don't embarrass easily, dear." "I never thought for a moment you were a shrinking violet. But you haven't seen me in this fugue state. You don't know what I'm like, or—" "Oh, for goodness sake! You make it sound as if you're a regular Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or Ms. Hyde, which I'm sure you're not. You haven't beaten anyone to death with a cane yet, have you, Ms. Hyde?"
Ginger laughed and shook her head.
"You're something else, Rita." "Excellent. You'll bring so much to the organization."
Although Rita probably did not think of Ginger as another charity case, she had approached this recuperation and rehabilitation as a new cause. She rolled up her sleeves and committed herself to seeing Ginger through the current crisis, and nothing on earth was going to stop her. Ginger was touched by Rita's concern, and depressed by the need for it. They stopped at a traffic light, third car from the intersection, with cars, trucks, buses, taxis, and delivery vans crowding them on all sides. In the Mercedes, the cacophony of the city was muffled, but not silenced altogether, and when Ginger looked out the window at her side to search for the source of a particularly annoying engine roar, she saw a large motorcycle. The rider turned his head toward her at that moment, but she could not see his face. He was wearing a helmet with a tinted visor that came all the way down to his chin. For the first time in 10 days, the amnesic mist descended over Ginger. It happened much faster this time than it had with the black gloves, ophthalmoscope, or sink drain. She looked into the blank and shiny visor, and her heart stuttered, and her breath was pinched off, and she was instantly swept away by a massive wave of terror. Gone. First, Ginger became aware of horns. Car horns. Bus horns. The air horns of trucks. Some, like the high squeals of animals, some low and ominous, wailing, whooping, barking, shrieking, honking, bleating. She opened her eyes. Her vision swam into focus. She was still in the car. The intersection was still in front of them, though evidently a couple of minutes had passed, and the traffic ahead had moved. With the engine running but the gear shift in park, The Mercedes was 10 feet closer to the crosswalk and angled slightly into the next lane, which was what was causing the horn blowing as other vehicles tried to get around. Ginger heard herself whimpering. Rita Hannaby was leaning across the console that separated the driver's and passenger's seats, very close, gripping both of Ginger's hands, holding them down and holding them very tightly.
"Ginger, are you there? Are you all right? Ginger?"
Blood. After the jarring blasts of the horns, after Rita's voice, Ginger became aware of the blood. Red spots marked her lime-green skirt. A dark smear stained the sleeve of her suit jacket. Her hands were gloved in blood, as were Rita's hands.
"Oh, my God," Ginger said. "Ginger, are you with me? Are you back? Ginger."
One of Rita's manicured nails was torn off, with only a splintered stub sticking up jaggedly from the cuticle, and both her hands appeared to have been gouged. Scratches on the woman's fingers, on the backs of her hands, and on her palms were bleeding freely, and as far as Ginger could tell, all of the blood was Rita's, none of it her own. The cuffs of the gray St. John suit were wet with blood.
"Ginger, talk to me."
Horns continued to blare. Ginger looked up and saw that Rita's perfectly coiffured hair was now in disarray. A 2-inch-long scratch furrowed her left cheek, and blood tinted with makeup was trickling along her jaw to her chin.
"Ah, you're back," Rita said with obvious relief, letting go of Ginger's hands. "What have I done?"
"Only scratches," Rita said. "It's all right. You had an attack, panicked, tried to leave the car. I couldn't let you go. You might have been hit in traffic."
A passing driver, maneuvering around the Mercedes, angrily shouted something unintelligible at them.
"I've hurt you," Ginger said.
Sickness throbbed through her at the thought of the violence she had done. Other drivers sounded their horns with increasing impatience, but Rita ignored them. She took Ginger's hands again, not to restrain her this time, but to offer comfort and reassurance.
"It's all right, dear. It's past now, and a little iodine will patch me up just fine."
The motorcyclist, the dark visor. Ginger looked out the side window. The cyclist was gone. He had, after all, been no threat to her, just a stranger passing in the street. Black gloves, an ophthalmoscope, a sink drain, and now the dark visor of a motorcyclist's helmet. Why had those particular things set her off? What did they have in common, if anything? As tears spilled down her face, Ginger said,
"I'm so sorry."
"No need to be.
Now, I better get us out of the way."
Rita pulled handfuls of Kleenex from the box on the console and used them to grip the wheel and gear shift to avoid spreading bloodstains. Her own hands wet with Rita's blood, Ginger sagged back against her seat and closed her eyes and tried to stop the tears, but could not. 4 psychotic episodes in 5 weeks. She could no longer glide placidly through the gray winter days, defenseless, docile in the face of this vicious turn of fate, merely waiting for another attack or for a shrink to explain what was wrong. It was Monday, December 16th, and Ginger was suddenly determined to do something before she suffered a fifth fugue. She could not imagine what she possibly could do, but she was sure she'd think of something if she put her mind to it and stopped feeling sorry for herself. She had reached bottom now. Her humiliation, fear, and despair could not bring her to any greater depths. There was nowhere to go but up. She would claw her way back to the surface, damned if she wouldn't, up toward the light, out of the dark into which she had fallen. Chapter 3. Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. 1. Laguna Beach, California. At 8 a.m., Tuesday, December 24th, when Dom Corvaces got out of bed, he went through his morning ablutions in a haze resulting from the lingering effects of yesterday's indulgence in Valium and Dalmain. For the 11th night in a row, He had been troubled by neither somnambulism nor the bad dream that involved the sink. The drug therapy was working, and he was willing to tolerate a period of pharmaceutically induced detachment to put an end to his unnerving midnight journeys. He did not believe he was in danger of becoming physically addicted to, or even psychologically dependent on, Valium or Dalmane. He had been exceeding the prescribed dosage, but he was still not worried. He had almost run out of pills, and in order to get another prescription from Dr. Koblatz, he had fabricated a story about a break-in at his house, claiming that the drugs had been taken along with his stereo and TV set. Dom had lied to his doctor in order to obtain drugs, and sometimes he saw his action in exactly that harsh and unfavorable light. But most of the time, in the soft haze that accompanied continuous tranquilization, he was able to dress the shabby truth in self-delusion. He dared not think about what would happen to him if the episodes of somnambulism returned in January, after the drugs were discontinued. At 10 o'clock, unable to concentrate enough to work, he put on a light corduroy jacket and left the house. The late December morning was cool. Except for a few unseasonably warm days now and then, the beaches would not be busy again until April. As Dom descended the hills in his Firebird, heading for the center of town, he noticed that Laguna looked dull under a somber gray sky. He wondered how much of the leaden gloom was real and how much resulted from the dulling effects of the drugs. But he quickly abandoned that disturbing line of thought. In acknowledgment of his somewhat fuzzy perceptions and impaired responsiveness, he drove with exaggerated care. Dom received most mail at the post office. Because he subscribed to so many publications, he rented a large drawer rather than just a box, and that day before Christmas the drawer was more than half full. He didn't look at the return addresses, but carried everything back to the car with the intention of reading his mail at breakfast. The Cottage, a popular restaurant for decades, was on the east side of Pacific Coast Highway, on the slope above the road. At that hour, the breakfast rush had passed, and the lunch crowd had not yet arrived. Dom was given a table by the window with the best view. He ordered 2 eggs, bacon, cottage fries, toast, and grapefruit juice. As he ate, he went through the mail. In addition to magazines and bills, there was a letter from Lennart Sein, the wonderful Swedish agent who handled translation rights in Scandinavia and Holland, and a padded envelope from Random House. As soon as he saw the publisher's address on the label, he knew what he had. Finally, his mind began to clear, the fuzziness partially dispelled by excitement. He put down the toast he had been eating and tore open the large envelope, and an advance copy of his first novel slid out. No man can know what a woman feels when taking her newborn child in her arms for the first time. But a novelist who holds the first copy of his first book must experience a joy similar to that of the mother who looks upon the face of her baby for the first time and feels its warmth through the swaddling clothes. Dom kept the book beside his plate and could barely look away from it. He had finished his meal and had ordered coffee by the time he was able to tear his attention from twilight and examine what mail remained. Among other things, there was a plain white envelope with no return address, which contained a single page of white paper on which had been typewritten 2 sentences that rocked him. The sleepwalker would be well advised to search the past for the source of his problem. That is where the secret is buried. He read the passage again, astonished. The sheet of paper rattled as a tremor passed through him. The back of his neck went cold. 2. Boston, Massachusetts. When Ginger got out of the cab, she was in front of a 6-story, brick, Victorian Gothic building. A blustery wind slapped her, and the bare-limbed trees along Newbury Street rasped, clattered, and clicked, the sound of rattling bones. Huddling against the bitter wind, She scurried past a low iron fence and entered 127 Newbury, the former Hotel Agassiz, one of the city's finest historic landmarks, now converted into condominiums. She had come to see Pablo Jackson, about whom she knew only what she had read in yesterday's Boston Globe. She had left Baywatch after George departed for the hospital, and after Rita went off to do some last-minute Christmas shopping, for she had been afraid they would try to stop her. In fact, the maid, Lavinia, had pleaded with her not to go out alone. Ginger had left a note explaining her whereabouts, and she hoped they would not be too upset. When Pablo Jackson opened his door, Ginger was surprised. That he was a black man? That he was in his 80s? Those things were not surprising, for she had learned as much about him from the article in the Globe. However, she was not prepared for such a vital and vigorous octogenarian. He was about 5'8", slight, but age had not bowed his legs, bent his back, or rounded his shoulders. He stood militarily erect, in white shirt and sharply creased black trousers, and there was a sprightliness and youthfulness in his smile and in the way he waved her into the apartment. His thick, kinky hair had not receded, but it had gone so white that it seemed to glow with a spectral light, giving him a curiously mystical aura. He escorted Ginger into the living room, moving with the stride of a man 40 or 50 years his junior. The living room was a surprise, too. Not what she expected, either of a sedate old monument like the Hotel Agassiz or of Pablo Jackson, an elderly bachelor. The walls were cream-colored, and the contemporary sofas and chairs were upholstered in a matching fabric. An Edward Fields carpet of the same creamy shade provided relief from the dominant scheme by means of a deeply sculpted wave pattern. Color was provided by pastel accent pillows, yellow, peach, green, and blue, on the sofas, and from two large oil paintings, one, a Picasso. The result was an airy, bright, warm, and modern decor. Ginger settled into one of two armchairs that faced each other across a small table near a long bay window. She declined coffee and said,
"Mr. Jackson, I'm afraid I'm here under false pretenses."
"What an interesting beginning," he said, smiling, crossing his legs, resting his long-fingered black hands on the arms of his chair.
"No, really, I'm not a reporter."
"Not from people?" He studied her speculatively. "Well, that's all right. I knew you weren't a reporter when I let you in. These days, reporters have an oily smoothness about them, and they're an arrogant lot. Soon as I saw you standing at the door, I said to myself, 'Pablo, this bitty girl is no reporter. She's a real person.'"
"I need some help that only you can provide."
"A damsel in distress," he said, amused. He seemed not at all angry or uneasy, which she had expected he would be.
She said, "I was afraid you wouldn't see me if I told you my real reasons for wanting to meet you. You see, I'm a doctor, a surgical resident at Memorial, and when I read the article about you in the Globe, I thought you might be able to help."
"I'd be delighted to see you, even if you were selling magazines. An 81-year-old man can't afford to turn anyone away, unless he prefers to spend his days talking to the walls."
Ginger appreciated his efforts to put her at ease, though she suspected that his social life was more interesting than her own. He said,
"Besides, not even a burnt-out old fossil like me would turn away such a lovely girl as you. But now, tell me what this help is that only I can give you."
Ginger leaned forward in her chair.
"First, I've got to know if the article in the newspaper was accurate."
He shrugged.
"As accurate as newspaper articles ever are. My mother and father were expatriate Americans living in France, just as the newspaper said. She was a popular chanteuse, a café singer in Paris before and after World War I. My father was a musician, as the Globe said, and it's true that my parents knew Picasso and recognized his genius early on. I was named after him. They bought 20 of Picasso's pieces when his work was cheap, and he gave them several paintings as gifts. They had bon goût. They didn't own 100 works, as the paper said, but 50. Still, that collection was an embarrassment of riches. Sold gradually over the years, it cushioned their retirement and gave me something to fall back on as well.
You were an accomplished stage magician.
For over 50 years, he said, raising both hands in a graceful and elegant expression of amazement at his own longevity. That gesture was marked by the rhythm and fluidity of prestidigitation, and Ginger half expected him to pluck living white doves from thin air. And I was famous, too. Sans pareil, even if I say so myself. Not famous over here, so much you understand, but all over Europe and in England.
And your act involved hypnotizing a few members of the audience?
He nodded. That was the centerpiece. It always wowed them.
And now you're helping the police by hypnotizing witnesses to crimes, so they can recall details they've forgotten.
Well, it's not a full-time job, he said,
waving one slender hand as if to dismiss any such thoughts she might have had. The gesture seemed likely to end with the magical appearance of a bouquet of flowers or a deck of cards.
In fact, they've only come to me 4 times in the past 2 years. I'm usually their last resort.
But what you've done has worked for them.
Oh, yes, just as the newspaper said. For instance, a bystander might see a murder take place and get a glimpse of the car in which the killer escaped, but not be able to recall the license number. Now, if he glanced at the license, even for a split second, that number is buried in his subconscious mind, 'cause we never really forget anything we see. Never. So if a hypnotist puts the witness in a trance, regresses him in time, that is, takes him back in his memories to the shooting, and tells him to look at the car, then the license number can be obtained.
Always?
Not always, but we win more than we lose.
Why turn to you? Aren't the police department's psychiatrists capable of using hypnosis?
Certainly, but they're psychiatrists, not hypnotists. Hypnosis is not what they specialized in. I've made it a lifelong study, developed my own techniques that often succeed where standard methods fail.
So when it comes to hypnotism, you're a maven.
An expert. Yes, that's true. Even a maven's maven.
But why does any of this interest you, Doctor? Ginger had been sitting with her purse in her lap, and her hands at rest upon it. But as she told Pablo Jackson about her attacks, she clutched the purse tighter, tighter, until her knuckles were white. Jackson's relaxed demeanor changed to shocked interest and concern.
You poor child. You poor, poor little thing. De Molampie. Empire, from bad to worse. How horrible. You wait there. Don't you move.
He popped up from the chair and hurried from the room. When he returned, he was carrying 2 glasses of brandy. She tried to refuse hers.
No, thank you, Mr. Jackson. I don't drink much, and certainly not at this hour of the morning.
Call me Pablo. How much sleep did you get last night? Not much. You were up most of the night, woke up hours ago, so for you this isn't morning, it's the middle of the afternoon. And there's no reason a person can't have a drink in the afternoon, is there?
He settled into his chair again, and for a moment they were silent as they sipped their brandies. Then she said,
Pablo, I want you to hypnotize me. Regress me back to the morning of November 12th, to Bernstein's delicatessen. I want you to hold me at that point in time, and question me relentlessly until I can explain why the sight of those black gloves terrified me.
Impossible,
He shook his head.
No, no.
I can pay whatever...
Money is not the issue. I don't need money.
He frowned.
I'm a magician, not a physician.
I'm already seeing a psychiatrist, and I've broached the subject with him, but he won't do it.
He must have his reasons.
He says it's too soon for hypnotic regression therapy. He admits the technique might help me discover the cause of my attacks, but he says that might be a mistake because I might not yet be ready to face up to the truth. He says premature confrontation with the source of my anxieties might contribute to a breakdown.
You see, he knows best. I would be meddling.
He does not know best, Ginger insisted.
Angered by the vivid recollection of her recent conversation with the psychiatrist, in which he had been infuriatingly condescending.
Maybe he knows what's best for most patients, but he doesn't know what's best for me. I can't go on like this. By the time Goodhausen's willing to resort to hypnosis, maybe in a year, I'll no longer be sane enough to benefit. I've got to get a grip on this problem, take control, do something.
But surely you see that I can't be responsible.
Wait,
she interrupted, putting her brandy aside.
I anticipated your reluctance.
She opened her purse, withdrew a folded sheet of typing paper and held it out to him.
Here, please take this.
He took the paper. Though Pablo was half a century older than she, his hands were far steadier than hers.
What is it?
A signed release making it clear that I came here in desperation, exonerating you in advance for anything that goes wrong.
He did not bother to read it.
You don't understand, dear lady. I'm not concerned about being sued. Considering my age and the snail's pace of the courts, I wouldn't live to see a judgment placed against me.
But the mind is a delicate mechanism. And if something went wrong, if I led you into a breakdown, I would surely roast in hell.
If you don't help me, if I've got to spend long months in therapy, uncertain of the future, I'll have a breakdown anyway.
Desperate, Ginger raised her voice, venting her frustration and anger.
If you send me away, leave me to the well-meaning mercy of friends, abandon me to Goodhausen, I'm finished. I swear that'll be the end of me. I can't go on like this. If you refuse to help me, you'll still be responsible for my breakdown because you could have prevented it.
I'm sorry.
Please!
I can't.
You cold black bastard,
Ginger said, startled by the epithet even as she spoke it. The hurt expression on his benign and gnomish face stung and shamed her. Now it was her turn to say,
I'm sorry. So sorry.
She brought her hands to her face, bent forward in her chair and wept. He came to her, stooped down in front of her.
Dr. Wise, please, don't cry. Don't despair. It'll be all right.
No, it never will. Not ever like it was.
He gently pried her hands away from her face. He put one of his hands under her chin. Lifted her head until she was looking at him. He smiled, winked, and held a hand before her eyes to show her that it was empty. Then, to her surprise, he plucked a quarter from her right ear.
"Hush now," Pablo Jackson said, patting her shoulder. "You've made your point, and I certainly don't have an homme de boue, a soul of mud and ungenerous spirit. A woman's tears can move the world. Against my better judgment, I'll do what I can."
Instead of putting an end to her crying, his offer of help renewed her weeping, though these were tears of gratitude.
"And now you are in a deep sleep, deep, very deep, utterly relaxed. And you will answer all my questions. Is that understood?"
"Yes."
"You cannot refuse to answer. Cannot refuse. Cannot."
Pablo had drawn the drapes over the three-bay window and had turned out all the lights except the lamp beside Ginger Weiss's chair. The amber beams fell over her, giving her hair the appearance of real gold filaments and emphasizing the unnatural paleness of her skin. He stood before her, looking down at her face. She had a fragile beauty, an exquisite femininity, yet in her face there was also a great strength, almost masculine in quality.
Le juste milieu,
perfect balance, the golden mean, was nowhere better defined than in her countenance, where character and beauty were given equal weight. Her eyes were closed, and they moved very little beneath her lids, an indication that she was in a deep trance. Pablo returned to his chair, which stood in shadow, beyond the amber light from the single lamp. He sat, crossed his legs.
Ginger, why were you frightened by the black gloves?
I don't know,
she said softly.
You cannot lie to me. Do you understand? You can withhold nothing from me. Why were you afraid of the black gloves?
I don't know.
Why were you afraid of the ophthalmoscope?
I don't know.
Why were you afraid of the sink drain?
I don't know.
Did you know the man on the motorcycle on State Street?
No.
Then why were you frightened of him?
I don't know.
Pablo sighed.
Very well.
Ginger, we'll now do something amazing, something that might seem impossible, but which I assure you is possible. In fact, it's easy. We're going to make time run backward, Ginger. Nothing to it. We're going to send you slowly but surely back in time. You are going to get younger. It's already happening. You can't resist it. Time, like a river, flowing backward, ever back. And now it's no longer December 24th. It's December 23rd, Monday, and still the clock runs backward, a little faster. Now it is the 22nd. Now the 20th, the 18th. He continued in that manner until he had regressed Ginger to the 12th of November. You are in Bernstein's delicatessen, waiting for your order to be filled. Can you smell the hot baked goods, the spices? She nodded, and he said, Tell me what you smell. She drew a deep breath, and a pleased look overtook her face. Her voice became more animated.
Pastrami. Garlic. Honey cookies. Cloves. And cinnamon.
She remained in her chair, with her eyes closed, but she lifted her head and turned left and right as if surveying the deli.
Chocolate. Oh, just smell that cocoa pound cake.
It's wonderful, Pablo said.
Now, you pay for your order, turn from the counter, head toward the door, preoccupied with your purse.
I can't get my wallet in, she said, scowling.
You have the bag of groceries in one arm.
Got to clean out this purse.
Bang! You bump into the man in the Russian hat.
Ginger gasped and twitched in surprise.
He grabs your grocery bag to keep it from falling, Pablo said.
Oh, she said.
He tells you he's sorry.
My fault,
Ginger said. Pablo knew she was not talking to him, but to the doughy-faced man in the Russian hat, who was now as real to her as he had been that Tuesday in the deli. Apologetically, she said,
I wasn't looking where I was going.
He holds out your groceries, which you take from him.
The aged magician watched her closely. And you notice his gloves. Her transformation was instantaneous and electrifying. She sat straight up, her eyes popped open.
The gloves! Oh, God, the gloves!
Tell me about the gloves, Ginger.
black,
she said in a small, quavering voice.
Shiny.
What else?
No,
she cried, starting to get up from the chair. Sit down, please, Pablo said. She froze, half out of her seat. Ginger, I am ordering you to sit down and relax. She sat rigidly, her small hands fisted. Her radiant blue eyes were open wide, focused not on Pablo, but on the gloves in her memory. She looked as if she would bolt again at the slightest provocation.
You will relax now, Ginger. You will be calm. Calm. Very calm. Do you understand?
Yes. All right,
she said. Her breath came less rapidly than it had done, and her shoulders slumped a bit, but she was still tense. Ordinarily, when he put someone into a trance, he maintained total and instantaneous control of the subject. He was surprised and made uneasy by this woman's continued distress in spite of his admonitions to relax, but he could not calm her further. Finally, he said,
"Tell me about the gloves, Ginger."
"Oh, my God."
Her face twisted in fear.
"Relax, and tell me about the gloves. Why are you afraid of them?"
She shook.
Don't let them touch me.
"Why are you afraid of them?" he persisted.
She hugged herself and shrank back into her chair.
"Listen to me, Ginger. That moment in time is frozen. The clock is moving neither forward nor back. The gloves cannot touch you. I will never let them touch you. Time is suspended. I have the power to suspend time, and I have stopped it. You are safe. Do you hear me?"
"Yes,"
she said. But as she cringed against the back of her armchair, there was doubt and barely suppressed terror in her voice.
"You are perfectly safe."
Pablo was distressed to see this sweet girl so oppressed by fear.
"Time has been stopped, so you can study those black gloves without being afraid they'll get hold of you. You will study them and tell me why they frighten you."
She was silent, shaking.
"You must answer me, Ginger. Why are you afraid of the gloves?"
She only whimpered, so he thought a moment, then said,
"Is it really this pair of gloves that frighten you?"
"No, not exactly."
"The gloves on this man in the deli, they remind you of a pair of other gloves, perhaps from some incident long ago. Is that it?"
"Oh, yes. Yes."
"When did this other incident take place?"
"Ginger, what other gloves do these remind you of?"
"I don't know."
"Yes, you do."
Pablo rose from his chair, moved to the draped windows, and observed her from those shadows.
"All right. The hands of the clock are moving again. Time is moving backward again. Back. Back. All the way back to the time when you were first frightened by a pair of black gloves. You are drifting back. Back. And now, you are there. You are at the very time, at the very place, at the precise moment and spot where you were first frightened by black gloves."
Ginger's eyes were fixed on a horror in a different time, not in this room or in Bernstein's delicatessen, but in some other place. Pablo watched her anxiously.
"Where are you, Ginger?"
When she remained silent, he said,
"You must tell me where you are."
"The face,"
she said, in a haunted voice that made Pablo shiver.
"The face. The blank face."
"Explain yourself, Ginger. What face? Tell me what you see."
"The black gloves. the dark glass face.
Do you mean like the motorcyclist?
The gloves. The visor.
A spasm of fear throbbed through her. Be calm. Relax. You're safe. Safe. Now, wherever you are, do you see a man wearing a helmet and a visor and black gloves?
She began a monotonous chant of stark terror.
Ginger, you must be calm. Be calm, relaxed and at ease. Nothing can harm you. You're safe.
Afraid that he was losing control of her and would have to bring her out of the trance soon, Pablo moved quickly to her chair, knelt at her side, put one hand on her arm and stroked gently as he spoke to her.
Where are you, Ginger? How far back in time have you gone, Ginger? Where are you? When are you?
A pathetic cry escaped her, an echo out of time, the tortured response to a long suppressed terror and despair. He became very stern, switching from a soft to a hard voice.
I am in command of you. You are deeply asleep and completely in my control, Ginger. I demand that you answer me, Ginger.
A shudder, worse than any previous spasm, passed through her.
I demand that you answer. Where are you, Ginger?
Nowhere.
Where are you?
No place.
Abruptly, she stopped shaking. She sagged in the chair. The fear melted out of her face and her features went soft, slack. In a thin and emotionless voice, she said,
Dead.
What do you mean? You're not dead.
Dead,
she insisted.
Ginger, you must tell me where you are and how far back in time you've gone, and you must tell me about the black gloves, that first pair of black gloves, the ones you were reminded of when you saw the gloves on that man in the delicatessen. You absolutely must tell me.
Dead.
Suddenly, because he was kneeling beside her chair and was close to her, Pablo realized her breathing was extremely shallow. He took her hand and was startled by how cold it was. He pressed two fingers to her wrist, feeling for her pulse.
Weak. Very weak.
Frantic, he put his fingertips to her throat and located a slow and weak heartbeat. To avoid answering his questions, she seemed to be withdrawing into a sleep far deeper than her hypnotic trance, perhaps into a coma, into an oblivion where she could not hear his demanding voice. He had never encountered a reaction like this before, had never even read of such a thing. Was it possible for Ginger to will herself dead merely to escape his questions? Memory blocks erected around traumatic experiences were not uncommon. His reading and psychology journals sometimes turned up accounts of these psychological barricades to recollection, but they were barriers that could be dismantled without killing the subject. Surely, no experience could be so horrendous that a person would rather die than remember it. Yet even as Pablo pressed his fingers to her throat, the throbbing of her pulse grew fainter and more irregular.
"Ginger, listen," he said urgently. "You don't have to answer me. No more questions. You can come back. I won't insist on answers."
She seemed suspended on a terrible brink, teetering.
"Ginger, listen to me. No more questions. I'm finished asking questions. I swear it."
After a long and frightening hesitation, he detected a slight improvement in her pulse rate.
"I'm no longer interested in the black gloves or anything else, Ginger. I just want to bring you back to the present and out of your trance. Do you hear me? Please, hear me. Please. I've finished questioning you."
Her pulse stuttered shockingly, but then it throbbed more steadily.
Respiration improved, too. As he talked to her in that reassuring manner, she quickly got better. Color returned to her lovely face. In less than a minute, he returned her to December 24th and woke her. She blinked.
It didn't work, huh? You couldn't put me under.
You were under, he said shakily. Too far under. She said,
Pablo, you're trembling. Why are you trembling? What's wrong? What happened?
This time she went to the kitchen and poured the brandy. Later, at the door of Pablo's apartment, as Ginger was leaving to meet the taxi that Pablo had summoned for her, she said,
I still can't think what it could be. Nothing so terrible has ever happened to me. Certainly, nothing so bad I'd rather die than reveal it.
There's something very traumatic in your past, Pablo said. An incident involving a man wearing black gloves, a man with what you said was a dark glass face, perhaps a motorcyclist like the one that panicked you on State Street. It's an incident you've buried very deep, and which you seem determined to keep buried at any cost. I really think you should tell Dr. Goodhausen what happened here today, and let him proceed from there.
Goodhausen is too traditional, too slow. I want your help.
I won't risk putting you in a trance and questioning you again.
Unless your research turns up a similar case.
Not much chance of that. I've done a lot of reading in psychology and hypnosis for 50 years, and I've never heard of anything like it.
But you're going to research it, aren't you? You promised.
I'll see what I can find.
And if you discover that someone developed a workable technique for getting through a memory block like this, you'll use it on me.
Ginger was mystified, but she was also considerably less distraught than she had been when she first arrived at Pablo Jackson's apartment. At least they had gotten somewhere, even if they did not yet know where. They had found the problem, some mysterious, traumatic experience in the past, and though they had not learned a single detail of it, they knew it was back there, a dark shape waiting to be explored. In time they would find a way to throw a light on it, and when it was revealed she would know the cause of her fugues.
Tell Dr. Goodhausen, Pablo said again.
I'm pinning all my hopes on you.
You're damn stubborn, the old magician said, shaking his head.
No, just persistent.
Willful?
Just determined.
Ashane.
When I get back to Baywatch, I'll look up that word, and if it's an insult, you'll be sorry when I come back on Thursday, she teased.
Not Thursday. The research is going to take time. I'm not going to hypnotize you again unless I can find a record of a similar case and can follow someone else's procedures, knowing they succeeded.
Okay. But if you don't call by Friday or Saturday, I'll probably come back and bust my way in. Remember, you're my best hope.
I am your best hope, only for want of anything better.
You underrate yourself, Pablo Jackson. She kissed him on the cheek. I'll be waiting for your call.
Au revoir.
Shalom.
Outside, as she got into the cab, she remembered one of her father's favorite aphorisms, and, like a lead weight, it counteracted her new buoyancy.
It's always brightest just before the dark.
3. Chicago, Illinois. Winton Tolk, the tall, jovial black patrolman riding shotgun, got out of the police cruiser to buy 3 hamburgers and cokes at a corner sandwich shop, leaving his partner, Paul Armis, behind the wheel, and Father Brendan Cronin in the back seat. Brendan glanced at the shop, but he could not see inside, for the big front windows were painted with festive holiday images. Santa, reindeer, wreaths, angels. A light snow had just begun to fall, and the weather forecast called for 8 inches by midnight, which meant tomorrow would be a white Christmas. As Winton got out of the car, Brendan leaned forward and said to Paul Armas,
"Yeah, well, nobody's knocking going my way, but what about It's a Wonderful Life? Now there was a terrific picture."
"Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed," Paul said.
"What a cast."
They had been talking about great Christmas films, and now Brendan was sure he had hit upon the best of the best. Lionel Barrymore played the skinflint. Gloria Graham was in that, too.
"Thomas Mitchell," Paul Armas said, as outside, Winton reached the door of the sandwich shop. "Ward Bond. Gad, what a cast."
Winton had gone into the sandwich shop.
"But you're forgetting another great one. Miracle on 34th Street."
"That was terrific, sure. But I still think Capra's better."
It seemed that the gunshots and the startling cascade of shattering glass came at the same instant, with not a fraction of a second between. Even with the car door shut, the heater fan making noise, and the police band radio crackling and chirruping, the shots were loud enough to halt Brendan in mid-sentence. As the explosions blew away the Christmas piece of the uptown street, the sandwich shop's painted window tableau dissolved, erupted in a glittering spray. New shots overlaid the echo of old reports, and the blasts were accompanied by a brittle and atonal music of glass smashing on the roof, hood, and trunk of the cruiser.
"Oh, shit!"
Paul Armas tore the dash-mounted riot gun free of its clasps, throwing open his door even as the glass was still raining.
"Stay down!"
he shouted back at Brendan, and then he was out, crouching, moving around the car and using it as a shield. Stunned, Brendan looked through the window at his side, back toward the sandwich shop entrance. Abruptly, that door was flung wide open, and two young men appeared, one black, one white. The black man wore a knit cap and a long navy peacoat, and carried a semi-automatic, sawed-off shotgun. The white man, in a plaid hunting jacket, was armed with a revolver. They came out fast, half-crouched, and the black man swung the shotgun toward the patrol car. Brendan was looking directly into the muzzle. There was a flash, and he was sure he had been shot, but the rear passenger side window in front of his face remained intact. Instead, the front window exploded inward, fragments of glass and lead pellets showering across the seat, rattling off the dashboard. The near miss shocked Brendan out of his daze, and he rolled off his seat to the floor, his heart hammering almost as loud as the gunfire. Winton Tolk had had the bad luck to walk unsuspecting into the middle of an armed robbery. He was probably dead. As Brendan pressed himself to the floor of the squad car, he heard Paul Armas shouting outside, "Drop it!" Two shots cracked. Not a shotgun, revolver fire. But who pulled the trigger? Paul Armas or the guy in the plaid hunting jacket? Another shot. Someone screamed. But who had been hit, Armas or one of the robbers? Brendan wanted to look, but he did not dare show himself. Thanks to an arrangement Father Vikazic had made with the local precinct captain, Brendan had been riding as an observer with Winton and Paul for 5 days. In an ordinary suit, tie, and topcoat, he was supposed to be a lay consultant employed by the church to study the need for Catholic charity outreach programs, a cover story which everyone seemed to accept. Winton's and Paul's beat was uptown, an area bordered by Foster Avenue on the north, Lakeshore Drive high-rises on the east, Irving Park Road on the south, and North Ashland Avenue on the west. It was Chicago's poorest and most crime-ridden neighborhood, home to blacks and Indians, but mostly to Appalachians and Hispanics. After 5 days with Winton and Paul, Brendan developed a strong liking for both men and a deep sympathy for all the honest souls who lived and worked in those decaying buildings and filthy streets and who were prey to the packs of human jackals among them. He had learned to expect anything riding with these guys, but the sandwich shop shootout was the worst incident yet. Another shotgun blast slammed into the car, rocking it. Brendan curled fetally on the floor and tried to pray, but no words came. God was still lost to him, and he cowered in terrible solitude. Outside, Paul Armas shouted, "Give it up!" The gunman said, "Fuck you!" When he had reported to Father Vikazic after a week at St. Joseph's, Brendan had been sent to another hospital, where he'd been given work on the terminal ward, a dreadful place with no children at all. There, as at St. Joseph's, Brendan quickly discovered the lesson that Stefan Vikazic expected him to learn. To most who were at the end of life, Death was not to be feared but welcomed, a blessing for which they thanked God rather than cursed him. And in dying, many who had never been believers became believers at last, and those who had fallen away from faith came back. There was frequently something noble and deeply moving in the suffering that accompanied a person's exit from this world, as if each shared, for a while, the mystical burden of the cross. Yet, that lesson learned, Brendan remained unable to believe. Now, the fierce beating of his heart hammered the words of the prayer to dust before he could speak them, and his mouth was as dry as powder. Outside there was shouting, but he could not make sense of the words anymore, maybe because the people shouting were incoherent, and maybe because he was partially deaf from the gunfire. He did not yet fully understand the lesson that Father Vikazic had hoped he would learn from this uptown portion of his unconventional therapy. And now, as he listened to the chaos outside, he knew that the lesson, regardless of its nature, would be insufficient to convince him that God was as real as bullets. Death was a bloody, stinking, foul reality, and in the face of it, the promise of a reward in the afterlife was not the least persuasive. The shotgun discharged again, followed by the roar of the riot gun, then by shouting and the slap, slap, slap of running feet. It sounded like a war out there. Another blast from the riot gun, more shattering glass, another scream, more horrible than the one that had rent the air before it. Yet another shot. Silence. Silence, perfect and profound. The driver's door was jerked open. Brendan cried out in surprise and terror. "Stay down!" Paul Armas said from the front seat, keeping a low profile himself. "Two dead, but there might be other shitheads inside."
"Where's Winton?" Brendan asked.
Paul did not answer. Instead, he grabbed the radio microphone up front and called Central.
"Officer down! Officer down!"
Armas gave his position, the address of the sandwich shop, and requested backup. Lying on his side on the floor of the squad car, Brendan closed his eyes and saw, with heartbreaking clarity, the pictures that Winton Tolk carried in his wallet and that he proudly displayed when queried about his family. Pictures of his wife, Rainella, and his three children.
"Those rotten fucking bastards,"
Paul Armas said, his voice shaking. Brendan heard soft clicking and scraping sounds that puzzled him until he realized Armas was reloading. He said,
"Winton's been shot?"
"Bet on it."
"You might need help."
"It's on the way."
"But he may need help now," Brendan said.
"Can't go in there. Might be another one. Two more. Who knows? We gotta wait for backup."
"Winton might need a tourniquet. Other first aid. He might be dead by the time help gets here."
"Don't you think I know that?"
Paul Armas said bitterly,
furiously.
He finished reloading and slid out of the car to take up a position from which he could watch the shop. The more Brendan thought about Winton Tolk sprawled on the floor in there, the angrier he became. If he had still believed in God, he might have quenched his anger in prayer, but now it fed on itself and grew into a hot rage. His heart pounded even harder than when the shotgun blasts were crashing into the car inches from him. The injustice of Winton's fate, the unfairness, the wrongness, was like an acid eating at Brendan. He got out of the car and started across the sidewalk, through the falling snow, toward the entrance to the sandwich shop.
"Brendan!"
Paul Armas shouted from the far side of the police cruiser.
"Stop! For God's sake, don't!"
Brendan kept going, driven by his rage and by the thought that Winton Tolk might need immediate first aid to survive. A dead man in a plaid hunting jacket was lying on his back on the sidewalk. A round from Armas's revolver had taken him in the chest, a second round in the throat. There was a stink of loosed bowels. In the snow beside the corpse lay a handgun, perhaps the very one with which Winton Tolk had been shot.
"Cronin!"
Paul Armas yelled.
"Get your ass back here, you idiot!"
Moving past the broken windows, Brendan could see into the shop, which was surprisingly dark. The lights had been shot out, or a switch thrown, and the gray daylight penetrated only a couple of feet inside. He could not see anyone, but that did not mean it was safe to enter.
"Cronin!"
Paul Armas shouted. Brendan went to the entrance, where he found the black man in the peacoat. This one had been hit by a shotgun blast
that also demolished the glass door. He was crumpled in a thousand bright fragments. Stepping over the body, Brendan entered the sandwich shop. He did not have his Roman collar, which might have been something of a shield if he had been wearing it. On the other hand, degenerates like these would probably kill a priest as reflexively and as happily as they blew away police officers. In his suit and tie and topcoat, he was as ordinary and vulnerable as any man. But he did not care. He was that furious. Furious that God did not exist, or, existing, did not care. At the back of the small shop was a service counter. Behind the counter was a grill, other equipment. On this side were five very small tables and 10 chairs, most of which had been toppled. On the floor were a couple of napkin dispensers, ketchup and mustard bottles, scattered $1 and $5 bills, a lot of blood, and Winton Toke. Not bothering to study the overturned tables to see if a gunman was sheltering behind them, Brendan went to the officer, knelt beside him. Winton had been hit twice in the chest, not with the shotgun, probably the other thug's revolver. The wounds were sickening, far too traumatic to respond dramatically to a mere tourniquet or first aid procedures. His breast was mantled with blood, and blood trickled from his mouth. The pool of blood in which he lay was so deep that he appeared to be floating on it. He was still, eyes closed, either unconscious or dead. "Winton?" Brendan said. The cop did not respond. His eyelids did not even flutter. Filled with a rage akin to that which had caused him to heave the holy chalice against the wall during Mass, Brendan Cronin gently put both hands on Winton Toke's neck, one on each side, feeling for the throbbing carotid arteries. He detected no life, and in his mind he saw the photographs of Raynella and the Toke children again. And now he was seething with resentment at the indifference of the universe.
"He can't die," Brendan said angrily. "He can't."
Suddenly he thought he felt a thready pulse, so faint it was virtually non-existent. He moved his hands, seeking confirmation that Toke lived. He found it. A less feeble beat than that first phantom drumming, though no less irregular.
"Is he dead?"
Brendan looked up and saw a man coming around the side of the service counter, a Hispanic in a white apron, the owner, or an employee. A woman, also in a white apron, had risen from behind the counter. Outside, distant sirens were growing nearer. Under Brendan's hands, the throbbing in Winton Toke's neck seemed to be getting stronger and more regular, which was surely not the case. Winton had lost too much blood to stage even a limited, spontaneous recovery. Until the paramedics arrived with life support machines, his vital signs would deteriorate unavoidably, and even expert medical care might not stabilize his condition. The sirens were no more than 2 blocks away. Puffs of snow blew in through the shattered windows. The sandwich shop employees edged closer, numb with shock, in a haze of anger at fate's capricious brutality. Brendan trailed his hands from Winton's neck to the wounds in his chest. When he saw the blood oozing up between his fingers, his rage gave way to overwhelming helplessness and uselessness, and he began to cry. Winton Toke choked, coughed, opened his eyes. Breath rattled thinly and wetly in his throat, and a soft groan escaped him. Amazed, Brendan felt for a pulse in the man's throat again. It was weak, but definitely not as weak as before, and hardly irregular at all. Raising his voice over the shrieking sirens, which were now so near that the air trembled, Brendan said,
"Winton! Winton, do you hear me?"
The cop did not seem to recognize Brendan, or even to know where he was. He coughed again, and choked more violently than before. Brendan quickly lifted Toke's head a few inches and turned it to one side, to let the blood and mucus drain more freely from his mouth. Immediately, the wounded man's respiration improved, though it remained noisy, each inhalation hard won. He was still in critical condition and desperate need of medical attention, but he was alive.
Alive! Incredible!
All this blood, and he was still alive, hanging on. Outside,
Three sirens died, one after the other. Brendan shouted for Paul Armas, excited by the hope that Winton could be saved, but also panicked by the possibility that medical attention would arrive seconds too late. He glanced at the sandwich shop employees and shouted, "Go! Get them in here! Let them know it's safe! Paramedics, damn it!" The man in the apron hesitated, then moved toward the door. Winton Toke expelled bloody mucus and finally drew an unobstructed breath. Brendan carefully lowered Winton's head to the floor again. The cop continued to breathe shallowly, with difficulty, but steadily. Outside, there were shouts and doors slamming and running feet coming toward the sandwich shop. Brendan's hands were wet with Winton Toke's blood. Unthinking, he blotted them on his coat, and it was then that he realized the rings had reappeared on his hands for the first time in nearly 2 weeks, one on each palm, twin bands of raised and inflamed tissue. Cops and paramedics burst through the front door, stepping over the dead man in the navy peacoat, and Brendan quickly moved out of their way. He backed up until he bumped against the service counter, where he leaned in sudden exhaustion, staring at his hands. For a few days following the first appearance of the rings, he had used the cortisone prescribed by Dr. Heaton at St. Joseph's, but when the rings had not reappeared, he had soon stopped applying the lotion. He had almost forgotten about the marks. They had been a curiosity, baffling but of little concern. Now, as he looked at the strange marks, he heard the voices of those around him, fuzzy and strange.
"Jesus, the blood! Can't be alive, place in the chest. Get the fuck out of my way! Plasma!
Type his blood. No, wait, do it in the ambulance."
Brendan finally looked at the crowd around Winton Toke. He watched the paramedics as they worked to keep the wounded man alive, get him on a stretcher, and move him out of the sandwich shop. He saw a cursing policeman dragging the dead man out of the doorway to make it easier for the paramedics to exit with Toke. He saw Paul Armas moving along beside the stretcher. He saw that the blood in which Toke had been lying was not merely a pool, but a lake. He looked at his hands again. The rings were gone. 4. Las Vegas, Nevada. The Texan in the yellow day-glow polyester pants would not have tried to get Georgia Monotella into bed if he had known she was in the mood to castrate someone. Although it was the afternoon of December 24th, Georgia was not yet in the Christmas spirit. Usually even-tempered and easygoing, she was in an exceedingly sour state of mind as she strode back and forth through the casino, from the bar to the blackjack tables and back to the bar again, delivering drinks to the gamblers. For one thing, she hated her job. Being a cocktail waitress was bad enough in a regular bar or lounge, but in a hotel casino bigger than a football field, it was a killer. At the end of a shift, her feet ached, and often her ankles were swollen. The hours were irregular, too. How were you supposed to provide a stable home for a 7-year-old daughter when you did not have a job with normal hours? She also hated the costume, a little red nothing, cut high in the crotch and hips, very low at the bust line, smaller than a bathing suit. An elastic corset was built in to minimize the waistline and emphasize the breasts. If you were already small-waisted, with generous breasts, as Georgia was, the get-up made you look almost freakishly erotic. And she hated the way the pit bosses and casino floormen were always hitting on her. Maybe they figured any girl who would strut her stuff in an outfit like that was an easy lay. She was sure that her name had something to do with their attitude as well. Georgia, J-O-R-J-A. It was cute. Too cute. Her mother must have been drunk when she got creative with the spelling of Georgia. It was all right when people heard it, because they had no way of knowing she spelled it cute, but she had to wear a name tag on her costume. J-O-R-J-A. And at least a dozen people a day commented on it. It was a frivolous name, misspelled like that, so it gave them the idea she was a frivolous person. She had considered going to court to have the proper spelling made legal, but that would hurt her mother. However, if guys at work kept hitting on her, she might even have it changed to Mother Teresa, which ought to cool off some of the horny bastards. And fending off the bosses was not the worst of it. Every week, some high roller, a big shot from Detroit or L.A. or Dallas,
dropping a bundle at the tables, would take a shine to Georgia and ask the pit boss to fix him up with her. A few cocktail waitresses were available. Not many, but a few. But when the pit bosses approached Georgia, her answer was always the same.
To hell with him. I'm a waitress, not a hooker.
Her routine, cold refusal did not stop them from pressuring her to relent, which they had done an hour ago. A wart-faced, bug-eyed oil man from Houston, in phosphorescent yellow pants, a blue shirt, and a red string tie, one of the hotel's favorite clients, had gotten the hots for her and had made inquiries. His breath stank of the burritos he had eaten for lunch. Now the bosses were angry with her for refusing a highly valued customer for being too stuffy. Rainey Tarnell, the blackjack pit boss on the day shift, had the gall to put it just like that.
Honey, don't be so stuffy.
As if falling on her back and spreading her legs for a stranger from Houston was merely the equivalent of a fashion gaucherie like wearing white shoes either before Memorial Day or after Labor Day. Though she hated being a casino cocktail waitress, she could not afford to quit. No other job would pay her as well. She was a divorced mother raising a daughter without benefit of child support payments, and in order to protect her credit rating, she was still paying off bills that Alan had run up in her name before walking out on her, so she was acutely aware of the value of a dollar. Her wages were low, but the tips were exceedingly good, especially on those occasions when one of her customers started winning big at cards or dice. On this day before Christmas, the casino was two-thirds empty and tips were bad. Vegas was always slow, Thanksgiving and Christmas, and the crowds did not return until December 26th. The whizzing, rattling, ringing of slot machines was muted. Many of the blackjack dealers stood idle and bored in front of empty tables. No wonder I'm in a sour mood, Georgia thought. Sore feet, back pain, a horny creep who figures I ought to be as available as the drinks I serve, an argument with Rainey Tarnell, and no tips to show for it. When her shift ended at 4 o'clock, she hurried to the changing room downstairs, punched the time clock, slipped out of her costume and into street clothes, and was out the door into the employee parking lot with a speed that would have drawn praise from an Olympic runner. The unpredictable desert weather did nothing to instill the Christmas spirit in her. A Las Vegas winter day could be cold, with bone-numbing wind, or it could be warm enough for shorts and halters. This year, the holiday was warm. Her dusty, battered Chevette started on only the third try, which should have improved her mood. But listening to the starter grind and the engine cough, she was reminded of the shiny new Buick that Alan had taken with him 15 months ago, when he had abandoned her and Marcy. Alan Rykoff. More than her job, more than any of the other things that irritated her, Alan was the cause of Georgia's foul mood. She had shed his name when the marriage had been dissolved, reverting to her maiden name, Monotella, but she could not as easily shed the memories of the pain he had inflicted on her and Marcy. As she drove out of the parking lot into the